That was Aurora on Planet Waves FM Pacifica Radio Network. I'm in Sag Harbor, New York today, speaking with Professor Carl Grossman about all things related to journalism. Carl, in the early 1990s, the dioxin issue was coming to the forefront. And it had been to the forefront really for since Agent Orange, Love Canal, the Times Beach incident where someone sprayed a bucket of Love Canal, basically a bucket of dioxin tainted oil, and the entire town had to be bought by the federal government. The zip code was dissolved, and this went on for a while until in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a little honest branch of the EPA headed by a guy named William Sanjor, which called for it's a little bit different than that. The pulp and paper industry wanted to get out of this idea that dioxin was so terrible, and so they called on the EPA to do a reevaluation of the toxicity of dioxin. And it ends up in the hands of this guy, William Sanjor, who is honest. And what happens is all the papers start coming in saying, no, this stuff is, you're off by orders of magnitude on the toxicity, and the carcinogenicity is only a high dose effect, and really what you've got is hormone pollution. And it was really looking bad for dioxin in the pulp and paper industry. And then two things happened. The first thing that happened is a Monsanto scientist who wrote several fraudulent articles brought a libel suit against Peter Montague at the Environmental Research Foundation, which used to publish Rachel's Hazardous Waste News, the most exciting thing I've written. I used to look forward to getting my copy every Monday. Rachel's Hazardous Waste News. And he sued him for many millions of dollars for quoting Sanjor, who quoted a court document. It was all privileged communications. This very quickly made everyone averse to covering the issue. And at the same time, right around the same time, within a couple of years, a guy named Keith Schneider at the Times teams up with Vernon Houck at the CDC, and they publish the famous front page series of articles saying that dioxin is no worse for you than sunbathing. And because this is coming from the voice of God, the New York Times, it's picked up, it goes out by the New York Times News Service, it's carried by hundreds of papers around major metropolitan dailies around the country as gospel truth, and editorials are written, and it turns out the entire thing was fabricated. There was no science behind this. All the science went the other way. There was no legitimacy to the analogy to sunbathing, but it shut the story down. You, besides my work, you cannot find really any references to dioxin in the mainstream press, the commercial press, after Gaffey v. Montague and Keith Schneider's page one, six-part series. How do we get around that?
I wrote a book. It's called The Poison Conspiracy. I quote Sanjor. I spoke to him. In the book, I talk about this. Is Reagan had gotten into power, and it was the classic case of having the fox cliche guard the hen house.
But Clinton kills the reassessment. The reassessment dies under Bill Clinton around 1991. It's shoved.
But Reagan until Trump was the absolute worst. But I call it the poison conspiracy because, I mean, it goes way back. I mean, it's in this book, and this I didn't know when I started writing the book. I mean, I knew that Reagan had put all these people, for example, Ann Gorsuch, who was the mother of the guy who was on the Supreme Court, part of the arch-conservative
outdoorsy guy.
Yeah, and Rita LaValle.
EPA
General,
commissioner, right?
Aerojet General, a big polluter in California. But then as I jumped into the book, doing the research of speaking to Bill Sanjor, And doing the research about this, you know, this hideous situation, which was mirrored, in fact, it's gotten even worse, if it could be, during the Trump term, I began, for example, learning about Harvey Washington Wiley. There was this man, Harvey Washington Wiley, who was came out of Indiana, and he joined the Department of Agriculture as the chief chemist. This was like at the turn of the century, in the last century, when various food adulterants came in, you know, various chemicals were being...
Aspartame. Oh, no, turn of the last century. We took it. Preservatives and the...
1900.
Poisoning the food with saltpeter and...
Well, he created Harvey Wiley's poison squad to get a little media attention. He had some of his people chuck down some of these poisons and get attention. And between Harvey Washington Wiley's work and Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, how food was, meat particularly, was processed, Theodore Roosevelt signed the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. And in fact, Harvey Washington Wiley is a faux postage plant. The United States
stamp,
has issued
got a stamp
with Harvey Washington Wiley's picture up. I didn't know this until I started doing the research for the book. As a matter of conscience, and I believe the year was just a few years later, 1912, Harvey Washington Wiley resigns from government service. He's considered the father of the FDA, father of the Food and Drug Administration. That's what the stamp's about. Because he talks about how government puts enforcement, not to pass the law is one thing, but government puts the implementation of such a law really in the hands of those it's supposed to police.
The agencies become a revolving door. All the federal laws say, make regulations, the agency shall do this. Then the agency is populated by people from the companies it's regulating.
And it becomes even worse in terms of allowing inspection. Dr. Wiley writes a book, The Crime Against the Pure Food and Drug Law. It's a big book. I mean, it's hard to find. To quote from the book, I had to get my college, SUNY Old Westbury, where I teach, to order it from another college. Wiley had to publish the book himself. Chapter and verse about how the Pure Food and Drug Law was undermined fully, thoroughly, totally. And then I go into, in my book, still available, you got a used copy. I'll give you a copy when we leave today, The Poison Conspiracy. And I'm using the words poison and conspiracy.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds, I mean, some people in doing interviews back when I... Said, that sounds paranoid, conspiracy. But it is a conspiracy between the poisoners and the government regulators who are supposed to protect us to don't. So then I went through the FDA, various government agencies which are supposed to protect us on various levels, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in subsequent years, and that was created, NRC was created in 77, but between the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, what we should have in this country, in every country, in any country, is real, you know, protection of the public. But this is life and death stuff. I mean, look today. I mean, we're at 2022. Go to any hardware store, and you see, it's now made by, Bayer now owns Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
Makes what's this damn stuff called?
Roundup. Glyphosate.
Glyphosate. There's rows of glyphosate. I mean, there's been these huge court victories. I mean, particularly groundskeepers getting non-Hodgkin's lymphoma from using Roundup, this pesticide. It's the most ubiquitous. As a textbook in my environmental journalism class that I've taught for decades, I have the students, even though it's now published to we're talking 1962, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which took on DDT. But I mean, she, that book, you know, moved the government, really created modern environmental journalism. Again, as we were saying in the earlier segment, I got into journalism because of this notion that I saw on the top of the entrance of the Cleveland Press, give people the light, they'll find their own way. Rachel Carson writes Silent Spring. And the government finally, at long last, takes action against this terrible pesticide, DDT, and outlaws its, outlaws it, basically, though it's used in other countries.
Can we come back to this issue of a single slap suit by Gaffey, Bill Gaffey, against a guy with a newsletter?
Right.
It would be the equivalent of a Substack today. One page, front and back, brilliantly researched, footnoted. The story disappears. I did this piece for Lies of Our Times, documenting the complete erasure of the dioxin story. And at the same time, the Times comes along and says, it's no worse than sunbathing. And that is it. I mean, I'm not that old, but this is 32 years ago. This is taking place in 1990. And there's never really been a recovery of any honest coverage of this. And I think that led to the kind of deletion of covering these kinds of chemicals. There's not really honest coverage of glyphosate. It's said to be the most wonderful thing in the world. We had, I think, juror number three on the program giving us the view from inside the jury room. What a disaster. But who has that? Who carries that story except for, you know, my little Saltbox radio program? This is a really, I think this is a really serious problem, Carl.
Oh, yeah. No, I did a TV show. Like, I just showed it to my environmental journalism class with Mitchell Cohen.
Sure.
About Roundup, about this terrible chemical, this glyphosate. And, what Mitch wrote, you know, should be serialized like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was in the New
York
Magazine.
He was the founder of FAIR, right? Mitch Cohen was the founder of FAIR, is that correct?
No. That's Jeff Cohen.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Mitch, I covered originally in the, go way back here, in the 60s when he was a student at Stony Brook University and a rebel at Stony Brook because it was collaborating with the Pentagon in the Vietnam War. And Mitch and others in the collective that he led really did sit-ins, did protests at Stony Brook. When I first met Mitch, and then in New York, he's from Coney Island. He was the leader of the No Spray Collective, and he wrote this wonderful book with great contributors, you know? Mm-hmm. But what's in that book? It's so important. It's really a new Silent Spring. Is my review of the book, my writing about Mitch Cohen's book, was that it follows in the tradition of Silent Spring. Why isn't that being reported in mainstream media? And the reason has to do, and this is, I'm not telling anybody knew anything new, a failure of media, the failure of the press. And it has to do who owns the press, and it has to do with stupidity. I mean, journalists, some of them just don't get it. But with Roundup, court decisions after decisions, I'm talking about jury trials, have to have, you know, that stuff should be banned. But you go to any hardware store, go here in Sag Harbor into the
hardware store. 10-year-old could walk in and buy it.
Yeah, well, you see it, and then it's, you know, then it's made, it's used, and it's going to, I mean, this isn't, issues dealt with in environmental journalism ain't just the scenery. It isn't just proper planning and open space preservation. No. It's life and death
stuff. Yeah, there's murder being committed. There's intentional acts being committed by these companies. But my point, just to keep bringing this around, is look how simple it was. They plant a piece in the Times. It was a 1-2 punch. Monsanto sues Gaffey, a Monsanto scientist, to keep it at arm's length from, and the story is gone. And I think that this sets the tone for all coverage of the chemical industry to the present day. Yeah. And then one of McLuhan's observations is that electricity decentralizes. Mm-hmm. And so when you have the press, i.e. actual paper and ink, there's a sort of a central authority that can set the tone. That was completely abused in the case of the Times covering this, making up this whole story about sunbathing. And now we are in this completely diffuse environment of 50,000 Substacks. Every day I open up my email and I'm on some new Substack list being promised the alternative story, the truth, the actual truth. And these people don't know anything. I know their issues better than they do, and one after the next is completely clueless. Mm-hmm. So in that environment, where do we get leverage?
Well, it's
this environment, not that. We are in the environment that I'm describing. Where do we get any leverage to make a change?
I don't think you have to be the New York Times. I wish the New York Times would. And actually, in regard to Trump, the New York Times has been very good in the last several years. Very good, surprisingly good. Challenging Trump, exposing Trump, Haberman, her new book, co-author, excellent work on the Times. But still, it's like, Ibsen spoke about truth being a lion in the street. And the still small voice, biblical term, can convey the truth. I mean, I write a lot for Nation of Change. Counterpunch is an excellent website. I write for that. Op-Ed News. My books have been published largely by independent publishers. And there's been impact. I do a TV show, which is broadcast by Free Speech TV, aptly named, out of Colorado. And Free Speech TV has gotten it syndicated in nearly 200 cable TV systems in 40 states, on the Dish Network and the Direct TV Network, the major satellite TV networks. And it's the still small. You did even if you just for example, during the muckraking era, most of the muckrakers didn't work for the mainstream press, as we call it these days, the Pulitzer papers or the Scripps newspapers, which were very involved in the muckraking era. But they worked for magazines that just arose during that time, mm-hmm. out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
McClure's.
Well, photos, photography brings in the rise of magazines.
Yeah, well, Jacob Riis pioneered the use of flash photography, and that became very important in his crusading journey for the New York Sun. And then he wrote a book, of course, How the Other Half Lives, kind of pursuing his crusading journalism. But I consider some of the websites of today, like Counterpunch, like Nation of Change, like Op-Ed News, and I can name others, Truth Out and so on. They're like these magazines that arose during the muckraking era, which really carried the muckraking era. I mean, Lincoln Steffens and Ida Tarbell and they work for McClure's magazine. Upton Sinclair was able to, sometimes it was very difficult. He was ready to publish The Jungle himself, Upton Sinclair. But then a little press here in Long Island in Garden City decided to do it. It was enormous pressure by the meat industry to not allow that book to be published. I mean, the model in terms of industrial pressure was Silent Spring. The pressure put on Rachel Carson and the name she was called, this hysterical lady, you know, mm-hmm. sexist kind of, you know, to try to stop threats of lawsuits and so forth, mm-hmm. both against the publisher and the book and the New Yorker for running a serialization. But it's not the best of all possible worlds journalistically in terms of exposing the outrage of and in the book, again, published by an independent publisher, the Permanent Press, after Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, my first book with the Permanent Press, after major publishers wouldn't touch a book on nuclear power, I have a whole chapter on admitted consequences. And I do the same thing I did in my cover-up book. I took a scissor, and I went to various reports on the causes of cancer. And there were a succession of reports done by the U.S. government saying, I mean, get the book, and you can see page after page where I've cut out, for example, the Presidential Strategy Committee, I forget exactly the name, in terms of the sources of cancer. A majority of cancer cases seen are caused by pollution, by contamination, mm-hmm. much of which is caused by people smoking, but a lot of it is not. It's the poisons in the air we breathe and in the water we drink and in the food we eat.
But they're no worse than sunbathing.
Well,
now we find out the TCDD, yeah. which is up there with plutonium. So my question is, navigating this decentralized environment where the large places are completely co-opted, and that lawsuit by Gaffey and Monsanto mm-hmm. terrorized a lot of smaller places, but it terrorized the pretty much entire newspaper industry. I have trouble seeing a way around that. Now, I continue to persist as an independent journalist doing mm-hmm. the kinds of stories I do. The documents are easy enough to find. The writing the pieces, I think, is on the level of like carpentry plus editing. They're not that hard to write these pieces, but I'm not seeing where there can be the kind of leverage to do something like stop Shoreham or stop a nuclear park or even the Watergate story in the current environment where it's hard to get anything noticed. Yeah. Nothing can rise, hardly anything rises above the din.
Yeah, well, that's been a comment by a lot of media critics in terms of the Trump situation, that if you don't have the kind of media, and not that it was great, you don't have the kind of media structure as you had with the Washington Post,
right?
And Woodward and Bernstein being supported, and here you had a major newspaper. I mean,
Graham allowed it, and the editors allowed the anonymous source, and they had yeah. they had that source. I mean, a lot of things came together for that to happen.
Yeah, well.
But today it would be like you just be called a conspiracy theorist or just another Substack, or, you know, it was able to be noticed.
Well, then also today you have very sophisticated systems of disinformation, which you didn't have. There was no Fox News channel spreading lie after lie. I mean, it's not a, you know, you didn't have Murdoch, and it isn't just the Fox News Channel. I mean, he owns the New York Post. He owns the Wall Street Journal. He owns probably the most prestigious print publication in the English-speaking world, the Times of London. I mean, people are left with so-called alternate realities, which are not alternative realities. They're just lies peddled by these purveyors of mistruths, of lies, just confusing. And then meanwhile, you have like what's happening. I wrote a piece for, I'm on the board of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a piece a while back on this takeover of CNN by the Discovery people and this guy Malone and his background and how, you know, he's arch conservative and how that's going to change. I feared, and others, CNN, which is has been an independent news source. I mean, and then you're talking about sources. You have reliable sources. This wonderful media criticism program on CNN ending up folding, and its host being essentially fired. Now it's really a tough time for it's a tough time for the press, and a democracy is dependent on a free press challenging power. And it's not just, Eisenhower in his farewell address talked about the military-industrial complex that we have to challenge. In the original draft of his farewell address, said...
He talks about the problem of co-opting the media.
He talks the military-industrial-scientific complex.
Ah, even better.
Yeah, and then his science advisor got quite upset, and they eliminated that from the final draft.
So, apropos of that, what did you make of the COVID coverage? Mainstream.
Yeah, I it was very complex, the COVID coverage. Some of it was okay. A lot of it was not. It was like truly an epidemic, a pandemic was what it was called. And I don't know about the media. Problem here is digging into China and whether there's any causation between the Wuhan laboratory and the, I've done stuff in terms of biological warfare investigations. Right near where I live here, just off Long Island, there's a place called Plum Island.
Mm-hmm.
And Plum Island, in fact, was, its mission, Newsday, a major newspaper, and an excellent investigative reporter at Newsday documented this story fully. Plum Island's original mission was to poison the cattle in the Soviet Union.
Oh, great.
This is, in fact, how it began, how... Plum Island began was that there was a this guy was a full out Nazi, Eric Traub, and he who was very active actually in this area in the 1930s. He was very he used to go to there was a parade ground here in Long Island. The Nazis, more than New York metropolitan area, the Long Island Railroad
they'd have rallies.
Provided a special train.
And they'd have rallies out there?
Oh, yeah. They had, he went to Rockefeller University in the city. And in any case, when the war began, he was given the assignment of running a laboratory on the island of Reims in the Baltic, and its mission was to poison livestock in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
That was the mission.
So, I know that the lab release story has pretty much gone in mainstream. It is the primary counter narrative to the non-existent Wuhan wet market, non-explanation of what happened. They could not get a positive test out of it. They don't have anything, not even conclusive. They don't even have any probable cause. So the lab release has become the official counter narrative in the COVID story. That's still poo-pooed by the New York Times, even though I learned about it in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2020. In August of 2020, a New York Times writer, aspiring star science writer, did a story saying that 90% of the positives were false positives, according to officials at Wadsworth Labs in Massachusetts, because they're running the cycle threshold of the PCR way, way, way past their detection limit.
Mm.
But then, even though they admit that 90% of the positives are false positives, the Times still continues to run a number on the front page every day of cases and a number of deaths that does not take that into account. They should be reducing their number by 90%, but they don't. They still claim every positive is a confirmed case. So they're holding it 400 deaths a day, even though, if according to their own reporting, which they did that story several times in late 2020, it should be reduced by 90%. What do you make of that?
Well, I have not focused upon it. I mean, what interests me, as I say, is whether there was an accident at that Wuhan laboratory, because, I mean, here, after Traub came back to the United States under what was called Project Paperclip or Operation Paperclip.
Oh, he was an Operation Paperclipper, yeah, too? So it wasn't just nukes. It was a little bit of bio-warfare and a little...
And space stuff. I mean, Wernher von Braun...
Well, of course, the rockets are one and the same with the nuclear program.
And he came, he was brought here, and the Redstone rocket, I mean, he was based at the Redstone Army Arsenal and Alabama, and he was deeply involved. He was an SS officer in the V-2 rocket. And the Redstone rocket is really a replica of, was the first rocket in the United States arsenal capable of carrying a nuclear weapon. And he and his team of former Nazi scientists were central to that. And then he goes on, really, become very central to the U.S. Both space military program, becomes associate director of NASA. But Traub, after he comes, and it was the Rockefeller Institute, not Rockefeller University, that he studied in Princeton, which he studied during the war. And then he comes back under Operation Paperclip, and he goes to Fort Detrick, which has been a biological and chemical warfare center for the U.S., you know, mm-hmm. for many decades, and interests them in on this island, this Plum Island off Long Island, it's a mile and a half off Orion Point, to do the same thing the island of Reims did he worked directly under Himmler. An excellent book on this is Lab 257.
We know they spend money on gain of function. I mean, whether they're capable of it or not is another question. We know that it's in the budget, that Fauci was involved with it, that that EcoHealth Alliance was involved. Mm-hmm. We know that all of that, all those links and paperwork exist in a somewhat classical government-private partnership conspiracy. But I'm wondering about how it's possible that the Times can, like, just sticking to the coverage, right? Mm-hmm. We know that they claim they can do this. How the coverage can come out on day and say there's 90% false positives, and then the next day they don't adjust their numbers. It's kind of like reporting the mayor got assassinated on Monday, and on Wednesday they have him giving a speech, and they don't account for this discrepancy.
Well, I'll just give you an anecdote involving what I think could be a parallel, because there's been leaks from the Plum Island Laboratory.
Leaks of documentation or leaks of germs?
Of germs, a foot and mouth disease virus that got out of these purportedly sealed buildings.
And there's a theory that Lyme also came out of Plum Island.
In my view,
it's right near Connecticut,
10 miles away. In my view, it's how Lyme disease developed. In fact, before Mike Carroll wrote Lab 257, there was an excellent book by, and he was a Nazi hunter, the book is titled The Bolaris Secret, written by John Loftus. He was an attorney specialized in pursuing Nazis.
Belarus, sometimes pronounced, yes.
And he was in the Office of Special Investigation of the Department of Justice. This is after the war. And in this book, I'm going to just pick up the book. He tells, I'm quoting from the book, Nazi germ warfare scientists being brought to the United States after World War II. And we're talking about the development now of Plum Island in the early 50s. 53 is when it opened as a... to use biological warfare against Soviet lives. I mean, this piece that John McDonald, an excellent investigative reporter, as I say, wrote in Newsday, he went to a facsimile, covered the front page of Newsday in 1993. He got it through the Freedom of Information Act. Talks about documents and interviews disclosed for the first... Well, I'm trying to find out where the quote is. His piece, let's start it here. His article begins, a 1950s military plan to cripple the Soviet economy by killing horses, cattle, and swine, call for making biological warfare weapons out of exotic animal diseases at a Plum Island laboratory. Now declassified army records reveal, Loftus in his book, he talks about, I have received information about how the U.S. tested some of these biological agents on ticks on the Plum Island artillery range during the early 1950s. Most of the germ warfare records have been shredded. Here's the anecdote. I began investigating whether this Plum Island lab was involved in biological warfare in the early 70s. Goes long, but 50 years ago, goes back. I mean, I've been there three times. This is just an example of how the press can be manipulated. Beyond the being of the press being in collusion with, how the press can be manipulated. And also Newsday was, I was at the Long Island Press, and this is Newsday, the other big daily newspaper at the time in Long Island. Newsday continues, the press does not. And I was looking into biological warfare on Plum Island, what the Department of Agriculture then decided to do. It was originally run by the Army, but then, according to Lab 257, by Michael Carroll, he went to the National Archives. He's an attorney. And what he found was that there was a decision made early on not to, in fact, I can quote that book too. The Joint Chiefs of Staff found that a war with the USSR would best be fought with conventional and nuclear means. Destroying the food supply meant having to feed millions of starving Russians after winning a war. So the U.S. pulled away from biological warfare directed at animals, thinking we can nuke them. We'll nuke the Russians. In any case, I was interested still in biological warfare issues on Plum Island because, stories I had heard. In fact, one of the stories, this is later on after what I'm going to talk about, this tour of Plum Island, of national journalists, Newsday reported how African swine fever was found in, the story was about 1977, the story was published in, I think was the year was 71. African swine fever broke out in Cuba. And what Newsday did was connect the dots to a CIA operation in the canal zone, a boat with anti-Castro to Cuba, and African swine fever, and then stressed that the only place that African swine fever existed in the Western Hemisphere
was Cuba.
Was a Plum Island.
Oh.
Plum Island. So in any case, I'm investigating stories like this. And what happens with the Department of Agriculture then taking over the Plum Island lab? Because we'll just nuke the Russians, forget. The Department of Agriculture sets up opens for the first time Plum Island, the lab, to the press, figuring, I'm sure this was the motive, that they'd invite people from national media on a dog and pony show, take them to Plum Island, see the wonderful things being done on Plum Island, and they dilute anything I'd write. And again, Newsday was on the trail of this too. The night before the tour, I called the PR guy from the Department of Agriculture just to make sure we were to meet in Greenport and all, and take the, we would then go on to Orient Point and then take the government ferry to Plum Island. He said, look, Grossman, what was this biological warfare? All we do is defensive biological warfare. Yeah. And I said, defensive? I said, what do you mean? You know, some, and defensive, like somebody is coming.
There's an arms race. They're admitting that they're, by that, they're admitting that there's a bioweapons arms race.
Yeah, but I mean, some country is going to come here to poison our chickens. I mean, so I write a story that night saying for the first time,
They admitted
doing, in quotes, defensive biological. And the next day, I go to Greenport, and then we meet, and we go to Orient Point, take the ferry, go through this whole procedure, take off our rings and all that, and go into these labs, which were pretty. I mean, if you're a member of, I don't know, if you care about animals, to see animals dying in front of your eyes is like pretty good.
Oh, it was an active.
Oh, it was active. They were doing experiments on foreign animal diseases. That's what they said. Then finally we go into one laboratory. This is the front page of the Long Island Press the following day. How this scientist in a white coat lifts up a vial and says there's enough foot and mouth disease virus in this vial to kill all the cattle that live on Earth. In fact, he went on, there's enough foot and mouth disease virus in this cattle, in this vial, to kill all the cattle that ever lived on Earth. And then I looked and said, I said, why do you need all that foot and mouth disease
virus? Why do they have it right there? How do they take it out? Can it break if he drops it? It's in a test tube.
In the halls of this lab, there are all these freezers, just like freezers, like you have at home, with all these poisons and all these, you know, all these poisons. Some of them pass over to people. It's not just animals. But in any case, this guy then, like, reactively, quickly, look, it's not a biological warfare, says the scientist with the vial. I mean, this is mad science. Mm-hmm. And that's why what Eisenhower meant to say,
mm-hmm. military industrial scientific complex.
But meanwhile, then we go to lunch, and the island, this Plum Island, used to be the base of something called Fort Terry. And there's like a corregidor-like system of trenches. This was all during the Spanish-American War. They feared that a Spanish fleet would be heading west, and they'd be able to, from Plum Island and also Fisher's Island, which is on the north, shoot at the shell, the Spanish fleet. So we're in the mess hall, so to speak, the old mess hall of when it was an army base, Fort Terry. And my story at the Long Island Press ends up running on the A wire of Associated Press.
Hmm.
It was a big daily, 700,000.
And do you lead with this vial of foot and mouth disease that could kill every cow that ever lived?
No, this was the first day's story. The first day's story when I'm on the island is that headline, page one of the Long Island Press, for the first time the government has admitted doing biological defensive, biological warfare. And so when that broke on the AP wire, it screwed up the Dog and Pony Show. And then I'm seeing a bunch of the PR people from the Department of Agri pointing at me, eating whatever they were giving us to eat. I had to be careful, of course, on Plum Island, pointing at me.
You eat anything on Plum Island?
Well, the Dog and Pony Show was ruined.
Yeah.
Because as gullible as they thought maybe these national reporters were and how they can snow them with a claim that Plum Island just does nice things wouldn't work, because here's the whole defensive biological warfare component. And then in media, when something runs on the AP wire, it's like from Mount Sinai. I mean, it's like, this is the truth with a capital T. So wherever these journalists went back to write their story, whether it be in New York, or
They've still got to deal with the Washington fact Post. That they've got to they deal have with to the deal fact with, that this is a so, wire story from AP.
Right, said that there's defensive biological warfare work that goes on there. Just to end this little stupid, this stoopy or Plum Island, which is what I thought about with the situation of COVID, and I've been to China, as I, you know, the press there is very closed. You can't really do investigative reporting. A Chinese reporter who wants to survive in China is, was there a connection? Whether the bats from where they were selling food, or was there a screw up, a leak? The next time I went to Plum Island was in 78, and there was a leak. I mean, there's supposed to be negative pressure in this main layer building, and nothing can. It turns out foot and mouth disease virus got out and it infected the cattle that were in pens outside. They had to destroy the cattle. So that didn't. And then finally, the last chapter here on Plum Island, this is in the 90s, and I'm reporting about Lyme disease, when it, you know, when it first came about, and like some of the health authorities here in Long Island didn't want to stress Lyme disease. There was AIDS epidemic at that time. Grossman, they were telling me, the health commissioner, we got fatal diseases dealing with AIDS, and I still Lyme disease, chronic Lyme disease is real serious. And then I got a hold of the Bolera secret. And this whole, the writing there of the connection with the Nazi scientists working with ticks. And when I was a kid, my family used to go camping. We used to go from the city to Wildwood State Park and Wading River. There wasn't deer ticks then. There were dog ticks. I mean, there's a variety of small little ticks, but never the deer tick that carried Lyme disease. There were other kinds of, there still are other kinds of ticks, but... That was diagnosed, deer tick, Lyme disease, you know, after Lyme disease, named after old Lyme, 10 miles from Plum Island. In any case, now we're, I think, 93. I get a call, and John McDonnell gets a call from the congressperson from Long Island, who, you know, also has been focused on Plum Island. And he says that we're going to do a raid on Plum Island tomorrow.
Oh, come on.
No, this is Mike Forbes. And
how does this get out? That who wants a raid? You can't announce a cocaine bust. You can't announce that gambling, a dice game is going to get raided the night before.
Mike Forbes says, Carl, meet me at the ferry. the government ferry lot at Orient Point tomorrow.
Wear a black trench coat.
And so I go there, and there's John, who remains a good friend of mine, an excellent reporter, superb reporter. And Forbes, with the two of us in tow, go to the ferry that takes the government people back and forth of Plum Island. Says, I'm Congressman Mike Forbes. I represent this district. I'm going to Plum Island today, and we're going to... speak to the director and others. And the guy says, well, do you have an appointment? Do you do this? You do that? And the guy says, Mike Forbes says, I'm the congressman. And, you know, he's, and in any case, he just bulldozed his way onto the ferry. And then we go to Plum Island. And we march up to the director's office. There was a veterinarian named Harley Moon. And Mike sits down, and there's John and I. And says, I want to see every record you have on experiments with ticks on Plum Island. And for the next several hours, various scientists and others on Plum would go in and out of this office. They run back and in the end, like in the early afternoon, we don't have any records. And Mike says, how can this be? The government keeps records of everything, you know? I mean, we don't have any records. We don't have any records. Mike gets back to Washington, and he persists. He continues to push for records. Still no records. Jump ahead now to just a few years ago, a congressman from New Jersey, Chris Smith, a Republican. Now, here's the headline of what he tried to do. Pentagon may have released weaponized ticks that help spread Lyme disease, investigation ordered. This is the headline of Newsweek.
Newsday?
Newsweek, which is now mostly on, it's online. Mm-hmm. And he wanted the Inspector General of the Department of Defense to conduct a review into whether the Pentagon experimented with ticks and other blood-sucking insects for use as biological weapons between 1950 and 75 and so forth. And it goes on. Well, this was passed. This measure was passed in the House, but it never got through the Senate. So, I mean, I've gotten into this long story about Plum Island because my first thought about COVID is whether there was a leak from that lab in Wuhan. And again, I have this experience with, and just let me add this, even today, because Homeland Security now runs Plum Island, because they were so concerned of terrorists getting onto the island and getting at some of these poisons, all they got to do is get into one of these buildings, the big lab building in particular. And there's not the security it was when the Army was there. And the Governmental Accountability Office did reports after 9/11 about the vulnerability of Plum Island and of terror. It's if you take the ferry from Orient Point, Long Island, to New London, Connecticut, you pass right by mm-hmm. Plum Island, and all a terrorist needs, and there's no secret, no tail out of school, is a shoulder-mounted grenade launcher. And there's the main building, the main lab building, Lab 100, on Plum Island, and blow a hole in it, and, you know, it's negative pressure is not going to, and so forth. And but meanwhile, so what the government decides to do is to set up another lab, a bioterrorism lab, to be sited in Kansas, which is a real smart place in the middle of
everything,
the cattle country in the U.S. Kansas, which is to open next year. They've spent $1.5 billion.
On a BSL-4?
Yeah, be at a BSL-4 lab in Kansas, this biosafety, whatever the name. But meanwhile, there's this pressure. In fact, the guy who's running for governor in New York, Lee Zeldin, is leading this to keep the lab going on Plum Island. And a lot of environmentalists have joined in, feeling that the nature of Plum Island, you know, should be preserved. It should preserve Plum Island. But what Zeldin and some local officials feel is that because of the jobs, and so even though a bigger and better
the
lab,
jobs.
because of the couple of hundred jobs, they should keep this lab going, which is just, to me, just so nuts, and not close it. And then furthermore, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has, for many, many years, until recent times, everything that was experimented on and otherwise on Plum Island was either incinerated or just buried. So there's all kind of hazardous waste sites on Plum Island.
No.
So to preserve Plum Island is like making it Love Canal National Park.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes no sense. So in any case, I'm telling this whole story about Plum Island, this Cold War activity on Long Island, or just off Long Island, and compare it to... maybe with Wuhan, because whether, you know, a strain of a virus was weaponized by or experimented on and by the Chinese. But it's very hard. You can't really do investigative reporting in China. So that was my thinking of the possibility.
Fortunately, there's a lot of American connections. EcoHealth Alliance, Pete Daszak had the contract with Wuhan. You know, it's going on. I built the chronology of this angle of the the other ones too, but this got a separate chronology. It's pretty well documented that they were doing this and working with the Wuhan lab, and not that it's a strictly Chinese thing, but that it's a collaboration with this New York based nonprofit. Stick some quotes around that, Eco Health Alliance. Okay, one last question, and you can take this as a hypothetical, and imagine that you're the editor in chief of something, WAPO, New York Times, something, Politico. And you find out that a reporter has done freedom of information law requests around the world looking for any record of a sample of SARS-CoV-2 taken from a human. Mm-hmm. The little bottle that the guy held up of a foot and mouth, right? That's a bottle that's there, right? They'd have to admit to that at some point. And what if 209 governments, institutions, CDC, FDA, Health Canada, National Health Service of the UK, the equivalent in Australia, all say we have no record of a sample or of a paper indicating there is a sample of virus found in a person. How would you handle that story?
I would have, if I was the editor, I would have the team of investigative reporters at the Washington Post or Political at the New York Times spend a good deal of time. See, investigative reporting can't be done in a day or two.
So this took years to develop this portfolio of, and by the way, it's unanimous. This is actually true that there's 209 responses from these governments, state, provincial, federal, in the case of the U.S., massive agencies, all saying nobody has a sample of SARS-CoV-2 found in a human.
Well, the thing is that when there's the smoke of a cover-up, there's often the fire of a real outrageous thing that's going to happen or happened. That's how I got into the use of nuclear power in space. I saw a little item, and it was the Department of Energy Insider, a newsletter, speaking about two space shuttle launches in 1986, one being the Challenger would be the space shuttle, lofting space probes fueled with plutonium.
The one over, blew up over Florida had plutonium on board.
It didn't have plutonium. The next mission of the Challenger
next mission
was to have the May mission. And I didn't think anything of it. In fact, I even got a journalist in space application somehow. And I took it into school to show my students how journalists get it from NASA. Mm-hmm. I like to fly. I always take a window seat, and it's, I'm not technophobic. I couldn't live without my laptop and it said that there's been studies done. This is in the Department of Energy Insider of accident hazards and the potential. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, a FOIA request, and they're supposed to respond rather rapidly, whether they're going to give it to you or whether they're not going to give it to you. And I got nothing. Mm-hmm. And the months went by, and I realized I must have bumped into something here. Mm-hmm. And finally, about 9 months, I wrote a book on this. It's called The Wrong Stuff. Mm-hmm. The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. It's like a counterpart to The Right Stuff. Because finally, at the end of 85, I get the documents because I'm making a stink. I have this weekly column, and I've been in the lecture circuit about this cover-up going on with nuclear in space. I didn't know exactly what I'd walked into. And then finally, I get these documents. And they were scary. I mean, I wouldn't have been a journalist in space. They outline how they could be a catastrophic accident on launch. If one of those booster rockets on the side doesn't ignite, they have a tip-over accident where the whole shuttle falls down.
It lands
tips
in
over
Daytona.
Blows up on launch. And then in the lower atmosphere, the upper atmosphere. That's what I asked in my FOIA request. There's an accident on launch. 1 in 100 rockets, chemical rockets, have major malfunctions on launch.
Well, the Titan IV had lost 1 in 19, I think, or 1 in 20, 5% of the launches. There was an explosion. was one lost a year before the Cassini went up?
Yeah, there was it was a Titan IV.
That blew up, and they were sending up Cassini with 72 pounds.
Well, but then it was Cassini who was supposed to go on a, and did on a Titan. But in any case, I finally get these documents. But I had to push and push and push and carry on. They wouldn't give it to me for a long while because they said that was too technical. Mm-hmm. And there's no exemption under FOIA. And then finally, when I got it, two things. One, I would never... Reading about how accidents could easily happen, this was not a trip on a jet plane. This is like sitting on a huge Roman candle. And then they had this blue sleeve book, I have it upstairs, of how many people could end up killed and land left irradiated by the plutonium if that was released as tiny particles. But they whited out all the numbers. I mean, they must have used a pint of whiteout and all this stuff. And then finally, what they said was that they were not concerned about a catastrophic. The odds, the likelihood, I think was the words, of a catastrophic accident involving the shuttle is 1 in 100,000. So I kind of stood back. I teach ethics, journalistic ethics, to my students. But then I was actually heading for my first investigative reporting class at SUNY Old Westbury. January 28th, 1986. And I hear on the carb radio that the Challenger blew up. And I didn't have a cell phone that weren't around. I went to a payphone and I called The Nation. I've written for The Nation through the years. I said, did you guys know the next mission of the Challenger was to be a nuclear mission with a plutonium fuel space probe in May? And no, is when you put an editorial together for us. And I did. And was called The Lethal Shuttle, was the title. And I've been on that issue ever since, because actually even now I'm very much on that issue, because they're pushing today for nuclear reactors on the moon and in Mars and nuclear power, sending astronauts to get them there real quicker to Mars. I mean, what if, like I say, 1 in 100,000 chemical rockets have major malfunctions on launch, mostly blowing up. Mm-hmm. So you can have a nuclear reactor that can descend to the moon, where you can use solar power, same for Mars. And in terms of locomotion in space, movement in space, there's all kind of non-nuclear ways to do it, including solar sails. These are charged ions from the sun that are emitted. And the Japanese and us, in the last several years, have moved spacecraft, small spacecraft, with solars and so forth and so on. In any case, but going back to what you have to do, I mean, I've been on the space nuclear story. Oh, and then I also connected it to Star Wars. Why the hell is NASA using nukes in space when they could, you know, use long-lived batteries? Or there's all kind of, and then I find out that Star Wars, nobody kind of knew that then.
Was powered by nuclear explosions in space.
Well, that was Edward Teller's idea, but beyond that...
Oh, they didn't actually...
No, thing was to have laser weapons, hypervelocity guns, and particle beams on orbiting battle platforms with on-the-battle platforms, actual nuclear reactors or super plutonium systems. GE was producing such a system. And NASA, you know, even was set up as a civilian agency, realized where the money was in Washington, the Pentagon. So it began teaming up with the military in terms of weapons in space. That continues to this day. I mean, the Space Force, just watch.
It's back.
But in any case, it's on nuclear in space. It began for me in 1985, 15 years to 2000, 22 years since. Put it together, it's near 40 years I've been on this story, if you call it a story, terribly. I mean, NASA stopped using plutonium on satellites. This goes way back to the 60s. The Snap 9A accident, which occurs in, I think, 64 or 7, it didn't achieve orbit. Fell to Earth, had plutonium on it. It disintegrated into the atmosphere, spreading plutonium all over the planet, causing, according to Dr. John Goffman, causing spikes of cancer on Earth. And the kind of plutonium that's been used, the kind of nuclear materials which NASA and the Department of Energy and the National Nuclear Laboratories, Oak Ridge, Los Alamos, they're all involved in this push to use nuclear in space. Well, I mean, we're talking, it's like glyphosate. It's like Roundup. Mm-hmm. This is round and life and death stuff. And always, what I found in doing investigative reporting on environmental and energy issues for Lowy's more than a half century is virtually all polluting processes and products have alternatives which are safe, which are green. Their activities and their products that we can live with, whether it's glyphosate or having a rocket with nuclear material aboard and pressing the button and hoping it doesn't blow up or come back to Earth if it doesn't break out of our atmosphere. It's insane. It's just, it's beyond scientific madness. It's military madness. It's bureaucratic madness. And it's the duty of the press to challenge this kind of stuff. But the kind of stuff you're alluding to in terms of Wuhan and China and U.S. collaboration, that takes skilled investigative reporting over a long period of time to break out the story. And that's quite possible. It happens with some regularity. If a newspaper, radio station, if a TV station is fully committed to doing investigative reporting, no holds barred, not protecting Laura Lard when 60 Minutes wanted to do a piece on, and they had a whistleblower in hand. But the two brothers who were running Lorillard, the cigarette company, with that had then taken over CBS. So poor Mike Wallace's hands were tied. I mean, that's a terrible story involving probably the best investigative.
But in COVID, there's a third narrative. Okay. Narrative one is the wet market theory. Narrative two is the lab release. And narrative three, which is documented, is that 209 governments and institutions say they don't have any record of a sample of this thing that's now said to have killed more than 7 million people. You would think that they might have a sample if it had killed 7 million people, and they're reporting that conclusively. How do you shed some wisdom on this? How do we handle this? How do we handle this story? What do we do with this? They all say the same thing, unanimously.
Yeah, my life has been committed to doing crusading journalism all my life, ever since I was college and into 1960. Yeah. But there's a political process which should be brought to bear. And there should be people in Congress carrying on. I mean, I don't like paying $3.59 for gasoline either. But for all the carrying on and the screaming and the yelling about the inflation and the, I mean, these are serious economic problems. What I'm talking about is stupid activities by corporations and by the government, which not only threaten and not only endanger people on Earth, but are killing people on Earth. And the government has the risk. But again, we have a lot of the poisoners, like my poison conspiracy book, just suppressing that check and balance dynamic where the government would get involved. That's the legislative branch, when I talk about Congress people raising a furor. But there should also be people in, and there have been through the years, people in government who are on an administrative level, on an executive level, who know about somebody. I mean, like Bill Sanjour. Hugh Kaufman, I also quote Hugh Kaufman. Hugh Kaufman, in Poison Conspiracy, the beginnings of Poison Conspiracy, I quote, to weigh fare thee well. These two honest guys at EPA, Hugh Kaufman and Bill Sanjour.
And Kate Jenkins. But what if this is actually meaningful? What if it turns out that there is no virus because they're not admitting to having a sample of it. And this is governments worldwide.
Yeah.
Strange places. Some of these are coming in Arabic. Some of them are coming in with little seals and this kind of thing. And right. I don't believe there's any out of Russia, but pretty much throughout the world, unanimously saying we can't produce a record of this virus, completely contrary to the guy with the vial of hoof and mouth saying, if I drop this, it'll kill all the cows back to the dawn of time.
He didn't say if he dropped
it. Yeah. Well, I'm exaggerating slightly. But that's a pretty big story that they implemented all of this, and then they went through all these mitigation measures, and they announced a COVID mitigation measures court 24 hours after Trump declares an emergency. They had the whole thing set up, but then they can't produce the virus they're claiming is the cause of all of their actions, behaviors, and the money that was spent in the lockdowns and the unprecedented. Basically putting 4.4 billion people under house arrest. You would think if they put 4.4 billion people under a form of house arrest, which is half the world was locked down, that they could at least produce a record saying, yes, Joe Blow in this lab has isolated this virus.
Well,
what do we do with this story?
Well, it
can't produce that.
Again, it's the kind of baloney we got on Plum Island. We have no records of experiments with ticks.
But that's one government and one facility. Well, this is every government in every type of facility, including FOIL covers private organizations in some countries as well.
Well, what I.F. Stone talked about when he referred to government, the great muckraker investigative reporter, something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, about a whole government official's lie.
I think it was a simple quote, government's lie.
Yeah, and they do. I shouldn't have said all government officials lie.
Oh, there's.
I should have been exact, government's lie. But there's always people, there's always whistleblowers, there's always the deep throats that you can find, and I have found, through the years. And I mentioned the check and balance system, and I've referred to the press and the legislative branch and the executive branch, but also the judicial branch. I mean, I just got a call.
But let's not bury the lead. Why would they deny? Let's imagine that they have samples and studies saying they have the samples, purification studies, actual testing. Why would they say they don't when they do, when they're taking the action to, for example, lock 4.4 billion people into their homes? Why would they deny having a thing? Why wouldn't they proudly come out and say, look, we've got it?
I don't know. All I know is that in my cover-up, what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power book, I begin it with a quote from the Bible that I have set beside you life and death, light and darkness. I'm paraphrasing. I shouldn't paraphrase it. Choose life so you and your descendants may live. And it's a matter of choosing life, but some governments, look at the Nazi regime. Look at Putin today, frankly, with just the slaying of murdering all these people in the Ukraine in violation of some governments and some leaders of governments go over to the dark side. And I don't know, I think probably, and I'm no philosopher, but I think probably these forces of lightness and dark, good and evil, it's like a battery, you know, there's always a plus and minus, that there's this polarity in the universe of positive and negative, not just with ever-ready batteries. And what we have to do as humans is to struggle that the dark side doesn't win, doesn't control. And that's what World War II was about. And so many people lost their lives doing this. And again, I'm no philosopher. I'm just a plain old journalist writing kind of instant history of sorts. Is faced with, challenged with this this fight between this this conflict which has been perpetual, which has been constant, between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, between life and death. We must not only choose life, but with whatever our profession is, facilitate that. And then sometimes it'll take challenging this darkness, as to other countries mm-hmm. being in cahoots over something which, talking about death, has been, I mean, first person I knew who died of COVID was a buddy of mine from Newsday, Sam Markowitz. He was a great Newsday reporter. And he caught it. He caught it really early on. And he was dead pretty quick.
But shouldn't they have a sample if it killed him? I mean, isn't that kind of crazy that the New York State Health Department, CDC, FDA, nobody has a sample, but they're claiming it killed him? How do we know something else didn't kill him? And they're blaming this phantom, really, that they cannot. I mean, this is not one agency. This is every agency. Many of them requested multiple times, keep giving the same response. Isn't it possible that there's something far, far worse going on?
It's this calls for, like this whole thing with January 6th.
No, let's stick to this issue with
January.
This is hard paper admissions, evidence over and over again, over well over 2.5 years.
Well,
we don't have any.
Yeah, I mentioned January 6th because it was a while. There was a bit of a fog. And now, because of this January 6th committee, pretty clear what happened and how Trump orchestrated it. And I think what you're discussing is stuff that has to be exposed, just has to be exposed. And to do it, it's going to take probably governmental authority, governmental power. If there's a will, I think if there's a will, there would be the cliche a way to get at the truth of all these things mm-hmm. regarding COVID.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just one very salient fact.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot you could say about COVID, including how patients were treated and the use of various anti-inflammatories and so forth, and ventilation and induced comas and all of this. And I'll tell you, this was one of the difficult things that at the outset of the story for me was that I was accustomed to the government concealing the dangers of things. And then I suddenly had a story where it appeared that they were exaggerating the dangers to the point of not even having had developed a valid test. If it's getting 90% false positives, it can't be a valid test. There's no test with a passing grade of 10. What is that, like a L minus or something, right? There's, so this recontextualizes the whole issue when we just confront a fact that they all deny they have any of it. This would include what came out of a lab or what came out of a market or some other place, because if there is a virus, they should know about it before they claim to have it.
Or a combination of the lab and the market. If it came out of the lab and there's the market.
Yeah, sure. Right, the guy dropped the beaker at work, or he caught it from a bat. Then he went to the market and he bought a little fish. But we're at the point now where they can't even show that they have a virus. They can't give evidence of even having a sample taken from a person.
Well, it's like...
It's a big story, right? I mean, when you say that if this is true, it's a pretty big story.
Well, the problem is that, as I.F. Stone said, governments lie.
Which would mean they would all be denying it. They really do have some... But there's supposed to be a whole body of civilian scientific literature. Yeah. All of that says fundamentally the same thing.
Yeah.
That it's all metagenomics. Yeah. There's not actually a sample.
Yeah, yeah.
In silico primers made of just a snip of handwritten computer code put into the PCR, used to create. So anyway, this is where this right now, I think, is the crux of the COVID story.
Yeah.
And you have all of your mainstream health freedom people on board with the lab release, but they're not addressing the fact that so far no one's found anything that came from a lab either.
Yeah. Well, if in our time we get to the bottom of this, but there are issues. Oh, Lincoln's assassination, for example, and the decades go by, and some mysteries, so to speak, are never solved. But this one sure should be solved.
It's a big clue.
Yeah.
No sample.
Yeah.
Is a big clue.
Yeah.
Suggesting that something else, maybe many other things, happened. Anyway, I can't do an interview with someone of your knowledge and experience, particularly I wasn't quite aware that you had made these visits to Plum Island and had seen the test tube.
It was a vial.
And wore the booties and gave up your jewelry so you wouldn't take it home. And did they test you on the way out? Probably not.
You had to take showers.
Yeah, I see.
Decontamination showers.
I see, like a chemical bath.
No, I don't think it was that. I think the exotic methodology was to give us bars of Dial soap, if I recall.
Right. As we said in New Paltz, tide's in, dioxin's out. When they were cleaning up the dioxin-contaminated buildings with Tide, you could see the box of Tide right in one of my photos. And the guys were in moon suits, and they've got a box of Tide. I'd like to get that on a TV commercial. You know, if you're a housewife trying to do the laundry, and your child comes home playing in the love canal with dioxin, just use Tide.
Yeah.
Carl, thank you.
Pleasure.
All right. Should you ever want me to come in and be a guest presenter at your one of your journalism classes, I would most certainly make the trip out.
Well, we first knew each other when you came to Old Westbury, and you were being given a terrible time at New Paltz.
Well, we had great fun with them, though. We definitely had more fun than they did. The scene of the deposition at the president's table with Judith Ratner. They sent the deputy chief of the trial division down. They brought their biggest gun to depose you and defend the state against me.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't admit that I wasn't a journalist. They kept trying to make you admit that I'm not really a journalist. Journalists don't really make funny faces at the camera. Journalists don't do this. Journalists don't do that. They don't use copy machines. Nope.
Well, I mean, citizen journalists these days are a major component.
All that's left.
Of journalism, the bloggers, the podcasters, the folks on YouTube. It's a very important element because of the technology, which has enabled people to go beyond the printing
press.
Well,
the citizen journalist is a kind of a she was a statistician between jobs, and she started writing these FOIL requests. She's up in the Toronto area, and then she networked a group of people around the world and taught everyone how to file these requests, and she's amassed 209 of these responses at last count.
Good for her.
Christine Massey.
Well,
I consider her a truly valuable asset to the citizen media press corps.
Oh, sure.
All right. Once again, thanks for taking the time out.
Oh, sure.
And I will send you the link when we publish this. Probably the first program in November.
Oh, great.
All right. Wonderful. God bless, Carl.
Good.
Shabbat shalom.